Andrew Rossi's documentary, Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times, examines whether it remains essential in the multimedia and fast-paced news cycle of today to have fact-based, original reporting. The New York Times introduced a paywall this year, the second attempt to get electronic readers to pay. It lost two very popular editorial writers, Frank Rich and Bob Herbert. And in a sudden move, the paper announced that Bill Keller, its executive editor, will step down and be replaced by Jill Abramson. Now, the recent shakeups do not appear in the documentary, but here to discuss the behind-the-scenes look at the New York Times newsroom are Andrew Rossi, the director of the movie, Brian Stelter, writes for the Times, and Bruce Hedlund, who is his editor. Welcome to our show today. Guys, it's great to have you here. The movie is fascinating. I should probably point out that it opens, I guess, this Friday at the New Lincoln Center Theater. Is that right?
It does, as well as the Angelica.
At the Angelica downtown as well. When we were talking about this show today and I was talking to the producer, I said I wanted to allocate a little more time to talk to you guys because this this movie is really interesting. But it also raises so many questions that I don't think any of us here can really answer, but at least we can kind of dig into them a little bit. Andrew, I'm just curious, what made you decide to do a documentary about the New York Times and take this particular angle? Because the angle, it's really not just sort of what happens in a newsroom, but it's really about can this model of a major newspaper with bureaus all over the world and a print and a digital edition and fact-based reporting and all this, can this survive in this century? I'm just curious as to what was the motivating force
Absolutely.
Behind this.
Well, it's really true. The movie is about the sort of crisis afflicting the newspaper business, which has somewhat settled and abated in certain degrees, but is still a really challenging landscape for newspapers to operate in. And so in that respect, the film could have been made at the Washington Post, the LA Times, even Reuters or AP, really anywhere that has as its mandate boots on the ground reporting. The one sort of special element of the New York Times is the presence of David Carr, who really is the heart and soul of the film. He's somebody who struggled with drug addiction, come out on the other side to be a reporter of great insight, poetic writing, and really a wicked sense of humor. So he's, I think, a very effective Virgil to guide us through all the stories that the media desk is completing and that elucidate something about what is going to be the future of journalism.
Well, I know David as a storyteller. I mean, we've actually, the two of us have done The Moth together. He's told the story of his, and he wrote this book, Year of the Gun, which is all about his drug addiction and return from drug addiction. So he has a great character. And I must say, in the movie, I guess he's a guy that everyone will be talking about because he's quite a showman in the movie. And he's very passionate about the New York Times. And basically, people just have to say anything mildly disparaging about the Times, and he jumps down their throat and says, don't you be talking about my New York Times, like that. So I'm sort of sorry he couldn't join us here today. So he's a real partisan, and that's great because he also represents the ethic of great storytelling in newspaper writing. He writes this long piece about the bankruptcy of the Tribune Company, and we see what a great reporter and writer does to get that done, and how his editor works with that and all that. But I guess my question about the documentary, you're a newspaper, a New York Times partisan too, it seems like, because it's a very I think it's a very laudatory movie. You seem to come down on the side of an institution like the New York Times should survive and has relevance to us, and without it, there would be nothing for the aggregators to aggregate. Is that sort of where you came out of this, or am I oversimplifying your view?
Well, I wouldn't say that I am a partisan. I would say that I've been a lifelong reader of the New York Times. My family had it delivered to our door, and I've always had a great deal of respect for the paper. Several documentary filmmakers were trying to get at this problem of what's happening to the newspaper industry for the last couple of years, And it seemed like the New York Times and particularly the media desk, you know, reporting on what's happening to it would be a unique window into this problem. I can say that when I and my co-producer and co-writer, Kate Novak, went into this, we tried to disabuse ourselves of any preconceived notions about New York Times exceptionalism or anything of that sort. David, you know, says in the film that he is an exceptionalist.
Right.
But that's really his point of view. Really what we're trying to do is give viewers a front row seat to what happens in an institution which has, again, as its mandate, original reporting. And viewers can decide for themselves whether what they see there seems wasteful and archaic or whether, you know, vital conversations are taking place between editors and writers and an important yet expensive process is going on to create the paper for them every day.
Now, Bruce, as an editor of the Times, when this approach was first made to do a documentary, what was your reaction? Did you have trepidation about allowing so much access? Did you think it was going to be good for the paper or dangerous? What was your feeling?
No, I didn't think it would be necessarily good for the paper. It was presented to me that if I wanted to cooperate and my reporters wanted to cooperate, we'd do it. So I got all my reporters in a room and said, we can do this. There's a few conditions. If you don't want to do it, I won't ask again. Nobody has to participate. If enough people want to participate, then I would agree to participate. It was not really my idea of a lot of fun to have somebody follow me around, much as I have grown to like Andrew in that kind of stalkerish way. But the third thing I said was nobody should imagine this will be good for us. We're not doing this because this is good for our careers. Now, they're reporters, so they have a certain public face that I don't really have because I'm an editor. They are, as you say, boots on the ground, and I'm, I guess, boots at my desk. Andrew said, yes, you know, I like the Times. I want something that really reflects well. But, you know, I think since we've done that to other people, we knew enough not actually to believe that.
Right.
And so that was our attitude going in. Now, as it turned out, it is very laudatory of the Times, and I think it praises it for many good reasons, but that there was no guarantee going in. To us, Andrew is just a journalist following us the way we follow other people, and we don't give people guarantees. Mm. Neither did he.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you're a relative newcomer to the Times, and you started in the digital world. You had a successful site that was writing about the media, and then you were brought in. You were sort of, you know, brought into the most established sort of old media institution, the New York Times, which I guess the Times has done with some other people on the internet, like Nate Silver, which seems like a very smart way to go. Did you have any concern at all when that you were maybe going to lose, I don't know, some of your street cred or that you were going to lose some of your independence, that you would
I think for about a month I wondered why I needed editors at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, now it's been 4 years and I can't live without them. I think that's my favorite part about the film is that you see editors at work.
Mm-hmm.
You go into the page one meetings where I'm not normally allowed to go, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Reporters generally don't sit in on them. And you see the editors at work. And to me, that's a fascinating demonstration or display of why editors matter. I think when you get to the Times, it infuses you with a DNA. David Carr has said the same thing. You can't help but walk away feeling the significance of the institution, and more importantly, probably, the significance of original reporting. You know, I think if you spent a year filming the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or Reuters, you'd see similar storylines play out.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to argue against having boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I'm here talking to Andrew Rossi, Brian Stelter, and Bruce Headlam, all involved in the new documentary Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times. This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate here at WNYC and WNYC.org. But let's talk about some of the realities of the newspaper business, because that, you know, that's, I think, what's unique about the film is you're basically looking at an institution sort of under siege. You know, this is tough times for newspapers. And actually, the movie begins with kind of nice shots of newspapers coming out of the printing plant and being hung to dry and then packed into trucks. And I've got to say, when I was watching this, I was sort of thinking, it's like I'm looking at Colonial Williamsburg or something. I'm seeing, you know, how things used to be done by smithies and cobblers. It feels, as much as I love my newspaper and I love reading the newspaper on the subway, but this this somehow feels like the center cannot hold, like in this age where we're all reading stuff on our phones and our iPads and all this. And there seems to be a confusion to me, and this is in the book business too, where people confuse sort of physical books with books, which are actually things that people write, and the same thing of newspaper, print newspaper versus a newspaper that you read on your iPad or your tablet or your phone or whatever. Is it a big deal if the Times down the line says, you know what, we're only going to print the Sunday edition and everything else is going to be digital, or we're just going to get rid of the print edition altogether because 1% of the population at that point still wants it? Is that people make such a big deal out of print versus digital. Is it a big deal, do you think?
Well, economically it is, because the print still accounts for probably, I don't know, 70-75% of our revenue.
Because the advertising and the home delivery.
Yes, and the advertising is not nearly so lucrative online. So we've started charging. We'll probably figure out other ways to do that. I mean, that day will come. It's certainly not here yet, and it's not going to be here for some time. I think the digital versus print is a little bit of a canard. If you look at the Times, just how involved so many of its reporters are in our website, how often we kind of update the website, how many are on Twitter. We do, as David points out in the film, we do over 100 videos a month. It's the same news organization. We're on all these other platforms. Right now, the paper, you know, kind of pays the freight, and it is still something that people enjoy and most people still read. But we're engaged in all these other places. What it has meant, I think, is that the newspaper now probably has a different quality. If Brian's reporting a story out over the course of the day, 3 or 4 blog posts, some updates, some tweets, when we sit down to say, okay, it's going in the newspaper, we just can't repeat what we've done all day. You know, in newspapers, the second day of a big story, you say, well, it's the second day lead. Every lead now is a second day lead in a newspaper. You're sitting down and saying, okay, they're up with the news, they're up on the news. What's going to surprise, what's going to delight people, what's going to inform them, what's going to change their way they look at the story when they read it in the paper the next day? So in a strange way, they're complementary.
And what I think you see in print the next day is improved because it was online all afternoon, because it has evolved during the day and it's gotten better and people have contributed to it and people on Twitter have asked questions and poked holes in it. It doesn't mean that the first draft was inaccurate or wrong, but it means that our work can get better when it's online all day.
But since there's now this very important digital component, and it's only going to get more important as you rely on things like the iPad and subscriptions for devices like this, doesn't that change the kind of personnel you need? Because, you know, you're online, you're now asking reporters, reviewers to do more things where they're kind of TV stars, where they're, you know, they're on video and they're producing little, you know, not just writing columns about my favorite films, they're now talking to a camera about their favorite films.
Well, and we're not hiring for looks, if that's what you're asking, which would be pretty obvious if you look at our videos.
But it's a different skill set.
So some are, but I don't think all are. I don't think there's, I don't think we're at a day or near a day where everyone's required to make videos or everyone's required to use Twitter. There are days where I don't want to make videos, even though I enjoyed other days. You know, I don't think those skills are mandatory, but they are more valuable than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
I also think you can take a terrific journalist, someone who can report and write, and teach them the best way to do that on Twitter or in a video much more easily than the other way around.
Right.
Andrew, in making the film, you know, you came from a place where you were your family was a subscriber to the paper and you liked the idea of the paper. Clearly some impressive things, like you talked about, you know, David Carr is this unique figure and the Virgil of the piece. Were there some things that disappointed you about the Times? You sort of said, that wasn't as cool as I thought it would be, or that this seems more like the place wasn't as, there are aspects of the job that seemed more like drudgery than you thought it would be, or was everything kind of amazing?
We did spend a lot of boring days sitting together, didn't we?
Right. There was a lot of downtime, which was not exactly scintillating to capture. But I have to say, the film, although, you know, if people's impression is that it's laudatory, I think that's not the result of any sort of manipulation. It really is, you know, a work of fly on the wall observational documentary. So if the people come off in a certain way, that's the way people are interpreting it. One thing though that we do address are the failures in the reporting, in the run up to the war in Iraq, as well as the Jason Blair scandal. In investigating that a little more deeply, I was very troubled to learn the degree to which Judy Miller was seemingly both manipulated by the Bush administration and, you know, not vigilant enough about that. You know, we tackled that in the film, and I think that there, you know, what I found following David out into the country is that there's still a lot of sort of psychic wounds among readers about that failure. And, you know, I think that the world in which we live in now that has Twitter and other sort of tools of the insurgency to Truth Squad information that even we see in the pages of the New York Times are fantastic, and people are using them to be better informed consumers. And I think that's part of the message, is that it's not a sort of either or type of thing. It's not like the New York Times is supposed to be Zeus, you know, throwing thunderbolts down from the mountain. Mm. But the original reporting that takes place in the pages of the Times is really vital to a diverse news diet.
Mm-hmm. If I can add to that, we have to claw back trust. Every day we have to win our readers' trust and win it back in some cases, as you're saying, from those wounds that you saw out on the road and that David sees out on the road. We can do that by letting you in, I think. I think letting you in was one small way of doing that. There's lots of small ways to win back people's trust like that.
Well, you're on very active on Twitter, and you're great at that. And but it, doesn't Twitter make your life miserable on some level? Because it doesn't. I mean, but, you know, in the old days, you know, if somebody didn't like something in the New York Times, they would maybe write a letter to the editor and maybe it would get published or not. But now there's so many blogs devoted to ripping apart the New York Times, and people are tweeting stories and saying this was wrong or this was lame. Is that – do you find that you like that trial by fire?
I genuinely think it makes my work better. I really do. I try to reply to the people that are toughest critics, because usually if you reply – and other reporters have said this too – if you reply to your reader email from the toughest critics, they actually tone it back a bit. They're surprised you're even replying. Mm-hmm. People are not expecting that we're always going to engage. So if we do engage, I think we win pack people a little bit on that. I think it does make my reporting better. And the other thing Twitter does, it's an early warning system for breaking news. So it allows us to see news stories percolating up. If you had been watching Anthony Weiner's account really carefully in May, you might have seen something brewing.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel, Bruce? Do you Twitter thumbs up?
I don't. I sit very close to Brian, which I think is enough radiation exposure for me. I see its value as a listening tool. I see it probably less as a broadcasting tool. However, you know, what it has done, what the web has done, what all these new ventures have done is there's a whole raft of new competitors out there.
Right.
I mean, it was inconceivable 10 or 15 years ago an editor was going to come up to me and say, you know, did you see this report on TMZ? And, you know, we had two or three competitors back then. Now it's the whole world, and the world well beyond what we consider professional journalists. Mm. Does that complicate our life? Yeah, sure. But I'm not sure I want to live in any other world, frankly. It makes it much more interesting.
I'm speaking with director Andrew Rossi about his documentary Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times, with Times reporter Brian Stelter and editor Bruce Headlam. We're talking about how the paper is adapting to a changing media landscape. We'll have more after a break. This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm talking to Andrew Rossi, the director of the new documentary, Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times. And I'm also here with two people featured in the film, Brian Stelter, Times writer, and his editor, Bruce Headlam. Now, I want to just get into another character in the film, who I think comes off extremely well, is Bill Keller. I mean, personally, if I were Bill Keller, I would have this movie running on a loop at home, because he just he comes off in the film is that the Times seemed, at least as a viewer, seemed sort of dysfunctional under Hal Raines. You had the Jason Blair crisis of credibility with this guy who was making up all of his stories, which I guess I do, but I guess you're not supposed to do that at the New York Times. And then Bill Keller comes in, and he's very dashing. He's a good-looking guy, and sort of Robert Redford.
It's actually Josh Brolin.
Yeah, this sort of looks like Josh Brolin. But, you know, look, you do a million stories every day, and there are bound to be things. I mean, Jason Blair was just a crazy episode, clearly. But they're bound to be problems with editorial content because you're trying to cover the whole world. But I was a little bit interested actually in some of the things under the Keller regime that I guess is just wrapping up now. He's giving way to Jill Abramson. But to me, a big page one story it was maybe not of the same import as the war in Iraq, but it as a Times reader, it concerned me a little bit, was during 2008, during the election, there was this big story about John McCain having this inappropriate relationship with a lobbyist and named, I guess, Vicky Iceman. And that was the way it was sort of reported. There was a lot of innuendo in the story, and there wasn't any sourcing. We didn't know who was saying what. It was like people close to the McCain camp were concerned about Vicky Iceman and her proximity. And then the Times said that they stood by the story. And then later, it was actually sort of, there was a lawsuit against the Times, and they settled it with no monetary damages. But they did settle it, and they had to publish something that pretty much backed away from the story. Was that something you were aware of but chose not to cover because it you thought it was an aberration, or was that something you were thinking of maybe including in the documentary?
Well, it's not something that we thought to cover because I mean, I remember when that story came out, and I agree, I was really taken aback by it, and I don't know all the details about, as you say, the lawsuit, etc. We were really trying to grapple with such an overflow of stories about the media. You know, WikiLeaks comes to the fore as a huge story in and of itself, which really gives rise to this notion of a collision between old and new media. WikiLeaks initially not having to go through the New York Times or NBC to release its Baghdad video of Reuters journalists getting gunned down. And then, in fact, the New York Times taking source material from WikiLeaks and publishing in advance the Afghan war logs and the Iraq war logs, and indeed the state secrets ultimately. That, along with David's reporting on the Tribune Company and Sam Zell's culture of not only, you know, financial bankruptcy but sexual harassment at the Tribune Company, there were a host of other stories. And you know, the story that you reference is not one that really emerged as crucial to telling the media landscape story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tribune story that David Carr reported was such great reading. It was such great reporting, but also great reading because you had great clips in the movie of this guy Sam Zell, who is a great, just a like a Batman villain or something. He's just such a sort of caricature of a
central casting
of a heathen who comes in and says, you know, let's have a porn section in the newspaper. I mean, just sort of unbelievable. But that was a great, you know, that was a great section of the film in terms of showing what goes into reporting and storytelling and how much time it takes and how much work that takes, both from the writer and from the editor. But my question, I guess, for Bruce is, what's going to pay for that? I mean, in the old days, before newspapers were under siege financially, there was always going to be enough money to send somebody out for even times would send people out for months to get a good story on some beat, and then it would show up on page one. It'd be an amazing piece of reporting. But in today's environment where advertising is shriveling and fewer people are willing to pay for the news, can we still have a piece like that Tribune piece?
Well, since I probably have to sit down with my people who do my budget layer, I would point out in the case of that story, David primarily is a columnist. He writes for the Monday Business Section. He does some other writing. The Tribune story took about 6 months for him to report. And he did that while doing his column the whole time. And in fact, he did that story, interestingly enough. I had recently lost my newspaper writer who went to another section. I was waiting for a new one. Tim Aranga, who's in the film, who's the corporate media reporter, volunteered to do 6 months in Baghdad. So I had nobody to cover the Tribune story, and David just said, why don't you let me do it? So, in a strange way, it was an example of good budgeting because we didn't have anybody to do it. And David, as he often does, as all my reporters do, stepped up to help. In the future, I don't know entirely who's going to pay for that. Advertising has come back broadly across media. It has not come back to newspapers.
Where is it coming back to TV?
I think local TV. Brian probably knows. Local TV's done very well. Yeah. Television in general, they just had their upfronts and they're very, very happy. And obviously a lot of it's going online. But it seems that we broke people of the habit of advertising in newspapers, and we haven't been able to sort of reintroduce a new habit. Now, will that happen? I don't know. I certainly hope so. Part of the answer probably lies in charging readers. I know that's anathema to a lot of the digital culture, who always say, information should be free. They always seem to be referring to our information when they say that. I think we were over a very bad year. Andrew managed to be there during, layoffs and some very tough times. I don't really think those tough times are over for the newspaper mm-hmm. business, and I'm perhaps less sanguine that we're sort of out of that long, dark tunnel.
Well, in the film, you sort of posit a question, which is it's raised, I guess, most pointedly by writer Michael Hirshhorn, who writes for The Atlantic. At one point, he sort of predicts that the New York Times is on the brink of bankruptcy, and then you have another guy come on and refute that and say no, that was dumb and stupid and all that. But I would agree with Bruce that the jury's still out. There is no clear conclusion in the film, and I don't think in the world at large that this model can work anymore. What's your best case scenario? Do you think that the you raise the hope that Apple will come to the rescue and that the iPad is going to make a big difference? Is that wishful thinking, or is that something that you think really could happen?
Well, I'm pretty long-term bullish on tablets, not just the iPad, but tablets in general, because they are the closest thing to reading a paper online. Mm-hmm. It does recreate the experience of print. There's lots of reasons why we should want to recreate the experience of print. It's a discovery of articles you can't do online. There's advertisement placement of ads you can't do online. So there's lots of reasons why tablets can be viewed as a possible benefit, but it's going to be a long-term benefit. It's not going to save the industry this year. I think the best case scenario is that we train people and encourage people to pay in mm-hmm. large numbers, and that includes people my age who are not accustomed to paying for content except movies and music and video games, all the content they already pay for. It's the journalism we haven't converted them on yet. And if we can do that, if we can show them why it's worth paying for, to me that looks like a brighter future ahead.
But doesn't that come down to, you sort of can't unring the bell? I mean, I think one of the problems is that when the whole dot-com explosion happened around the turn of the millennium, around 2000, there was this headlong rush to put everything online for free. The magazines did it. The newspapers did it, thinking that advertising would have flocked to these sites and that would pay for everything, and it just didn't happen. But haven't we, in fact, as Brian would say, haven't we trained a generation to just say, well, look, I get the most useful website is MapQuest in my life. I mean, that shows me where to go. And so my feeling is like, if the most valuable website in the world is free, how am I going to pay for anything else? I just think
Then again, I have bought apps on my phone with maps on them, and I've paid for them. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's a different medium. It's not the web. On my phone, it feels like something different. It feels mm-hmm. like a tablet almost. It feels like something I carry. So I do pay for that.
So that could make the difference.
That's why the tablets are so significant, because it's mm-hmm. a different medium, or at mm-hmm. least it looks like it and feels like it. And if we get tablets down to a price point where people who are my, let's take my brothers, who are a little younger than me, they're in their early 20s, would never think of paying for the New York Times website. But they would think of buying an app. Mm-hmm. And that they do buy apps on their phone. If we can have them buying apps on tablets, maybe the New York Times app, that feels like a potential partial solution, not a full solution, but a partial.
And I'm just old enough that I remember when cable television came in and everybody was like, why would you pay for television? Television is free. Well, 90% of Americans now pay for television.
Yeah. Right.
So I think habits do change. And if you look broadly over the past 25 years, advertising across all media is a smaller piece. What consumers pay is a much larger piece. I think there's been a little bit of an aberration in the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. Yes, we threw everything up online. Pets.com's not trying to sell 50-pound bags of dog food online anymore, so maybe some of those ideas can get buried with those.
But we have to make the case for people to pay. you know, that's – I don't want to sound like a shill for the film, but one of my favorite scenes is at the end, of course, when you put up that slide that says, take action. Go to this website. There's this URL for the film. It's a campaign called Consider the Source. That, in a small way, is making the case for paying and making the case for buying the paper on the newsstand as well. Mm-hmm. We can't – I don't think we can sit back and hope that people will, on their own, figure out that they should support original reporting. We're going to have to be more aggressive about making that case.
And when we make mistakes, and we've mentioned some of them here,
yeah,
we really pay for them.
That's right. Probably more than ever because they're more public and more visible.
And because we're the Times and we represent a certain thing to many people. And, you know, I guess the problem with having standards is you do have to live up to them. And when we fail to do that, we really take a hit. And I'd argue we've actually taken financial hits from those.
Mm-hmm. What's your, you know, there's a great moment in the film, another David Carr moment where he's confronting, I guess, Michael Wolff at one of these panels, I guess, South by Southwest or something like that, where, you know, he's, you know, Michael, who runs a website, is an aggregator where he has lots of old media links, is being kind of blasé about the New York Times and its value. And David Carr holds up a sort of mock-up of Michael's homepage and what it would look like if all of those links were gone because all those institutions vanished, and it's just this, you know, Swiss cheese. It's just this piece of, you know, piece of paper with all these holes in it. How do you feel about the whole notion of aggregation? I mean, it drives traffic to your New York Times site, but on the other hand, you know, the Huffington Post sells for $300 million, and that seems like a great business because they're not paying for any, or they're paying for a little bit of their content, but not much of their content. What about that? You're putting up a paywall for readers, but the aggregators get your stuff for free just by linking to it, and is that a good thing? I mean, it seems like that's trouble too, or am I missing something?
Well, part of this is a legal issue, and so part of this is something that's fought out on the higher floors of the New York Times, where the lawyers figure out how to handle this, and in some cases they do step in. It's hard to argue that what the Huffington Post is doing most of the time is illegitimate because they are linking to the original source and they are giving us credit. I wish people would read both versions, though, mm-hmm. and that gets back to the speaking out about it and being proactive. Wish we'd encourage them to read both the Huffington Post version, which does have a sexier headline all the time than my stories, or then go back to the original story. There might actually be something of value there. And I think the case was made beautifully when David holds up those screen grabs and shows all the content that would be missing if it were not for the New York Times and the AP and Reuters and the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, I grew up in the aggregation business. I grew up, I had a blog in college about TV, and all I was doing was aggregating. I was breaking news here and there, but I was mostly linking other sources. There is a business model for both.
Mm-hmm. You're still working that off for us, aren't you?
and we aggregate too, don't we? We some of our best blogs summarize the best of the web for us. So we shouldn't pretend like aggregation is our enemy. It's not necessarily our enemy, but it's the riddle, and at least in my mind, the riddle every day of what the balance is between the two.
I was wondering when you mentioned, you know, what goes on in the top floors of the building. there wasn't a lot of presence in the film from sort of the business side. There's a couple moments from Sulzberger in there, but actually some of the problems of the Times in recent years have been created by the business side. I mean, there have been some, you know, some decisions that maybe in retrospect wouldn't have been the best decisions in the world. Did the Times need to move to a new building? Did they need to, sell the old building, do all these things that, you know, I don't know how, I'm not a real estate expert, but it's questionable when a business is not in sort of a upswing to sort of move to bigger digs. Did you want more access to the publisher and to his posse, or did you?
Does he have a posse?
Does he have a posse? But there wasn't a lot of him in the film,
and there
And I was curious to know because it does seem like, you know, you guys are in there trying to reinvent this kind of super tanker, which is a tough thing to do. But meanwhile, with one big decision, something could be done that could hemorrhage a lot of cash for everybody.
Right. Well, we did inquire with the publisher and the CEO as to whether they would sit for an interview, and they declined. And I think that's because there's really a very firm and high wall between the newsroom and the corporate side of the New York Times. The movie is really focused on the journalism and the craft that is sort of at risk if newspapers don't survive. And it was authorized by Bill Keller. It was really under the purview of the newsroom. So in a sense, we felt okay about the fact that we didn't have the publisher opining on the state of affairs,
right?
Because, you know, it's really the emphasis on the journalism.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Andrew Rossi, Brian Stelter, and Bruce Hedlund for the film Page One, which opens this Friday at the Angelica and the new Lincoln Center Theater. Guys, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.